Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Dr. Kevin Mitchell, author of Free Agents, How Evolution Gave Us Free Will. So Dr. Mitchell is an associate professor of genetics and neuroscience at Trinity College. The book was published last year by the Princeton University Press. He also writes the Wiring the Brain blog, which is really good. And it's funny because his latest entry discusses the work of Robert Sapolsky and his book, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will, which for the most part, other than a few odd twists, attempts to refute the premise of this work. And so Dr. Mitchell's research is aimed at understanding the genetics that lead to the wiring of our brains, what makes each of us, well, us, all equally subject to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and even to whether we all see the same red or even smell or taste it. And that research perforce leads Dr. Mitchell to the biology of agency and free will and to this book. So for those who follow this series, in the past few years, I've had the privilege of interviewing authors like David Chalmers, Michael Graziano, Frank Wilczek, Philip Goff, Donald Hoffman, and Chris Ferry. And just like Dr. Sapolsky and Dr. Mitchell, each has their own unique approach to the idea of awareness, the seat of human consciousness, and free will. So why do I mention that? Because my talks with these great minds were basically, in my opinion, about thought experiments, it's kind of simplified, that were non-falsifiable. That is, they could neither be proved or disproved. And that's why there's all this argument about it. Everything generally went back to Descartes and then forward to the same problem, from solipsism to the multiverse, the simulation hypothesis, the brain in the vat, and the meat puppet argument. Bottom line is, what is this feeling of something or thingness? And free will or free agency kind of comes at this from another angle, but leads to the same result for a curious mind, mine, seeking a solution to the most basic problem that our minds could ever come up with. So welcome, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me. Thanks for that really interesting introduction, because that really sets up the problem space that we're in here and the sort of different angles that people have taken up to it.
It's funny about David Chalmers, because he's like the godhead of this because of the easy and the hard problem. Some of the authors I've interviewed in their library, I can see reality plus behind in their actual library. Well, I guess we could start with Gnarls Barkley, because I haven't seen him mentioned in a book like this, and probably no one has asked you that question.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So, I mean, I quote the Gnarls Barkley song, Crazy, and especially the lyric, which goes, I'm not going to sing it. Who do you think you are? You really think you're in control? Ha ha ha, something like that. It's a nice kind of encapsulation of this question of, well, there's two questions, right? There's two allied questions there. Who are you? What kind of a thing do you take yourself to be? What is yourself, right? And then how could that self be the thing that's in control? Those and you know, those pretty much capture the metaphysical quandary of free will and this question of whether, especially, you know, if we think about a sort of a deterministic universe, a self, an entity, could ever be said to be a locus of causal power or able to do things as an entity, as opposed to just a complicated place where lots of events are happening. And that's kind of the question that I try to get at in the book. Where could that causal power come from? How could that emerge? How could entities with that kind of causal power emerge, which is just very different from every other kind of causation at play in the physical universe?
It's interesting. When I started the book, I thought, wait a minute, he's talking about determinism. And what's interesting is you set up the book by kind of making the other argument, and you cite people who have made that argument. And then you go on to set out the foundation on which you use to refute that premise. So How come you chose to do it that way, to set it out starting with the opposite viewpoint that you have?
I guess because that feels to me like the hook, right, that gets into people's brains, is that worry that we really are deterministic, that little niggle that maybe because our personality and our dispositions, say, are partly genetic and partly innate, that therefore it feels like we're not, you know, we didn't decide that, the way that our brains are wired, and therefore our will is not completely free or of our own choosing. There's that worry. There's the worry from neuroscience, which these days is just revealing more and more of the mechanisms of cognition and decision-making, so much so that it threatens to render the mental aspects of that epiphenomena, as if they're not doing any work. It doesn't matter what the contents of your thoughts are. It just is, the neural machinery is just whirring away, right? And then there's worries from physics as well. And so, you know, what I wanted to do was acknowledge these, first of all, sort of big metaphysical worries from philosophy, but also the new sort of empirically founded worries from recent science, physics and neuroscience in particular. But then I shift gears, because all of those questions are kind of about how could it be in principle that agents with causal power could exist, right? And what I wanted to do was say, well, let's raise the questions, but put them on hold for a little while, and let's ask a different question. How actually did agents emerge in the world? What actually happened in evolution that led to the emergence of organisms that at least seem to be making choices and seem to be able to control their own behavior? And so I defer the discussion of the metaphysical problems for a while until I hope, at least, have sort of naturalized some of the concepts that we're going to need to answer those questions without appealing to mysticism. And there are concepts like purpose and meaning and value, which sound a bit vague and nebulous. They don't sound super scientific. But I think they could be made scientific if we take the right approach to understanding even just like what it is to be a living thing. What does that entail?
Well, actually, if we go to the title of the book, I thought maybe the title would start with a concept of free will, but instead the book is called Free Agents. Yeah. And in America, people think of agents, okay, they're travel agent, or if you're a lawyer like me, a general agent, a special agent, a sub-agent, a servant, employee. So, but there's a different definition of agent and agency. Yeah. So let's explain that, because that's the title of your book.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, so the term free will gets at the idea that we can do things, we can take action in the world, that we as selves have control over that, and we make our own decisions and so on. That's what people generally kind of understand by that term. But that term, you know, applies to other organisms as well. If we have these metaphysical problems that supposedly undermine free will in humans, they might just as well undermine the idea that any organism can do anything, that it can take action in the world and be this locus of causal power in the world. So that's the more basic kind of idea of agency that applies to all living things to some degree. And I mean, this is the really crucial bit. That's the thing that really distinguishes living from non-living things, is that living things can act as these centers of causal influence and control in and of themselves at that level as entities. Whereas in the physical non-living world, nothing does anything. Things just happen, right? There's just lots of happenings, but there are no doings. And it's how we can get to things capable of doings that really is the central question of the book, because we have to solve that problem first if we're to get to grips with the much more complex instantiation of those powers in humans. That's my view anyway.
Well, what's the subtitle of the book? What is this gift that evolution granted us? Because you say gave, so evolution is giving us, which is, you know, tautological to a certain extent. Evolution is giving us this gift wrapped in a box and a ribbon. What is the gift?
Yeah. So the gift is this capacity for control. And you can think of, you know, complicated systems that may be things like self-organizing systems, like a whirlpool or a storm or a tornado or something like that, where there's a kind of a collective dynamic that's going on that keeps a system going for some period of time in a dynamic sense, right? But living things are somewhat like that. They are self-organizing systems, but they're also self-governing systems in that they're trying to keep themselves organized, and they succeed at doing that much longer than, you know, a tornado or a whirlpool or things like that, right? So it's that capacity of living things to do work, to keep themselves persisting through time. That's the sort of basic idea of what it means to be a living thing. And then it's the extra capabilities and functionalities that emerge through evolution that enable them to do that better, right? And doing that better can involve being aware of what's out in the world, being aware of how things are changing, being able to anticipate and predict conditions and react to them. So it's not just a matter of staying exactly the way you are. It's a matter of persisting by changing, by adapting to the world. And eventually in evolution, that becomes by acting on the world, right? Not just changing yourself in response to conditions out in the world, changing the world, right? So that's eventually that capacity for behavioral control is what I refer to as agency. And the reason I say evolution gave us free will is that you can track the emergence of those capacities as they get more and more sophisticated over evolutionary time, ultimately to the point where, you know, it's not just organisms doing things for reasons, which is a very basic kind of capacity. It's, you know, becoming better and better at predicting the future, having a more complex model of the world and the self, being better able to anticipate things, and eventually, you know, controlling things over far time horizons. And then in humans, getting to the point where we can even have a model of our own mind and a model of that control system. So we can reason about our reasons and think about our thoughts. And ultimately, that's the point that I would defend as meeting the reasonable criteria for what free will should be thought of as.
Well, so at the beginning, I said, you know, and this is your reader, you're looking for curious readers, you're looking for readers that may eventually, for want of a better term, go down the rabbit hole. And your notes and your illustrations, diagrams are really, really good. The notes are great. But so, like, as this curious mind, you know, I'm interviewing people who believe in panpsychism. Yep. So the stone that doesn't do anything actually has some type of sentience. Or, you know, I'm interviewing someone who talks about determinism, which you talk about at length, that, you know, the blind watchmaker, Dawkins, whoever, that from this tiny, infinitesimal, infinitely dense, smallest particle in the world, everything from that point, including our conversation, is already determined. And so what am I supposed to do? All these different people are coming at me from different angles. They are all non-falsifiable. Every single one.
Well, let me just assume for the moment that you're right, that they are all non-falsifiable. And that might be right. If that's the case, then what I would do is as a good Bayesian, right? So I have some balance of balancing the which of these theories I think might be right, based on some other evidence, right? And the other evidence might be, say, the phenomenology of our experience. So it feels right. Like we make decisions. It feels like we're in control of our actions. It feels like we have a reasonable way of expressing our reasons. We think about why we do things. You know, our mind is not just opaque to us. And it certainly doesn't seem like the words I'm saying right now could possibly have been predetermined at the start of the Big Bang, right? Right. So when faced with some alternate theories, I guess I would lean towards the ones that fit with our phenomenology versus the ones that absolutely refute it with no good evidence. That's my baseline, is starting with the things that seem to make sense. Of course, the problem is that the ones that make very sort of sensational claims, the ones that say everything you thought was wrong, they get great press, right? People love those ideas. They're like, ooh, that's cool. Everything I thought was wrong, that's neat. Whereas if you come out with a book that says everything you thought was right, and here's how it could be, well, that's a different angle. But I think, you know, I think that kind of those lines of evidence and argument are perfectly admissible in this debate. If something is an outlandish claim, like the idea that everything was predetermined from the Big Bang, including me talking to you right now, you know, that's a claim that's just absurd on its face. And if the evidence for it isn't up to the task, then I see no reason to take that kind of claim seriously.
Well, like, okay, I'll give you Sabine as an example, because I'm going to be interviewing Sabine in the next coming weeks. And you say Sabine magnanimously, which is always the way everyone talks about Sabine. It's like, notwithstanding, Sabine still contends. And what did she do wrong that everyone always has to say magnanimously? And I know what you meant when you said magnanimously or notwithstanding.
I forget the details of what I was quoting at that point. I think it was probably something along the lines of things that Sean Carroll, who's a physicist, says as well.
Which, yeah, you did. It was in the same sentence.
Okay, so their claim is that, so let me take Sean Carroll in particular. So he claims that the lowest levels that we know about of physics are what he calls causally comprehensive. So that means that the models that we have that describe, you know, it's basically quantum fields and sort of standard model of quantum physics are complete. That they're not only are they good enough as they are, they theoretically rule out any other causes coming into play. That I think is his claim. I hope that's fair. But at the same time, at the same time, he also says, nevertheless, it's perfectly plausible to have effective theories at higher levels of organizations. We can have theories of biological organisms and societies and economies and so on. And it's right to talk about them at their own level. We don't need to talk about economies at the level of quarks and quantum fields. So that's kind of the magnanimous thing. It's like, yes, you can have your, you know, sociology and biology, and anthropology, neuroscience, you can have your little theories, but we know it's all physics. But we know it's all physics at the bottom, right? So to me, it's a kind of, now maybe he would say he's not doing that, but it just very much sounds like he is, and it very much sounds like Sabine Hossenfelder is doing something similar. And I would rather them take their own claim more seriously, right? If they really think that the lowest level is causally comprehensive, then that's the level at which all the causal work is being done. And it just excludes the possibility of other kinds of causation coming into play, because you've already exhausted all the scope. That's my view on it anyway.
And that's what the reviews of Sapolsky's book touch on that too. They go, oh, he believes this, but then he says this too, you know?
Yeah. So I've had, you know, some interesting, an interesting debate with Robert, and our books have been co-reviewed in a few places. And as you mentioned, I've written a few blog posts that are direct responses to some of his arguments, because I wanted to, first of all, clarify what I was taking his arguments to be, and then secondarily, see if I could, you know, mount a more precise argument against them. And yeah, part of the problem is that there is an inconsistency in the way that he talks about things. So he talks about things as being completely determined, and that, you know, whenever we encounter any scenario, all this complicated machinery is going to whir away and come to one inevitable solution. So in every scenario, what we will do is, in a sense, predetermined by the configuration of our brain. There's no evidence for that. He doesn't present any evidence for that. Again, it's an extraordinary claim, and it doesn't fit with the phenomenology of our experience. But it also makes it, because it doesn't fit with that phenomenology, it makes it impossible for him to talk about what he's studying without using words like agency and doing and choosing and deciding. And so he still employs all of those words in a way that to me feels odd, because he has effectively ruled out any of those being real in the terminology that he's using and the view that he's proposing. So yeah, there's some inconsistencies there, which to me are telling. because they, I think it's a data point that it's so hard to talk about human behavior without using words like doing and choosing and deciding, right? Because we do choose and decide.
Well, you know, okay. So like I said, I didn't even mention all of them, but everybody who I've interviewed makes assumptions, which is necessary. I don't think this is an empirical question because we would know the answer by now. But if I employ what I like to employ, Occam's razor, then the simplest solution of all this is we live in a solipsistic universe. And you said meat puppets in your last interview. Either you're inventing me or I'm inventing you. And this interview is just me talking to myself. And that's pretty simple. It's the simplest. Would you act any differently if you knew you lived in a solipsistic universe? I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great scene from The Matrix where the traitorous guy goes back into The Matrix and he's at a restaurant.
The steak,
right? And he's
it's a really nice steak.
It looks really good, right? It's really well prepared piece of meat. Yeah, he knows it's not real and he doesn't care, and he articulates that. So it's interesting. Occam's razor gets deployed in ways that are a little too freewheeling for my view, because what Occam's razor is really about is not that the simplest theory is the best. It's that if you have two different explanations of something, and they're both equally good explanations of the thing that needs explaining, then the simpler one is preferred just kind of on pragmatic grounds. It's just easier to go along as scientists with the simpler one and operate on that basis and complexify only as we need to. So, you know, it's not a global statement that simpler theories are better in general, right? It's you still have to take into account that it's a theory that explains what needs to be explained. That's the bit. And so in our case, what needs to be explained is not just the feeling that we seem to be acting, but the observations that we make that other people and ourselves and other animals can act as causal agents in the world, that they can do things unlike other physical things. So for me, I still feel like that's a valid phenomenon that needs explaining. That's the target that I'm after, is trying to figure out how that could possibly be, how it could come to be. That's the real crux of the perspective.
The evolution. Is how it could
come to be. Yeah. And for me, you know, if you're talking about anything in biology, asking how it got that way is usually a very informative way to approach it.
Well, last question, then we'll get into the actual book, because we're trying to sell your book. So, and not to try to paint you into a corner, except I am, you know, if you, Feynman said it, Feynman says, you know, and I just interviewed a guy who wrote Beautiful Experiments, and you can have a beautiful experiment, but something doesn't quite work perfectly. So Feynman says, you just twist it a little bit here to make it work. You twist it a little bit here. And like, as Einstein said, the cosmological constant is the biggest blunder he ever made. Although now dark energy and dark matter, maybe it's not. But be that as it may, everybody I talk to seems to have to tweak something to make everything work. Mm-hmm. That's, again, I'm not a smart guy, but I'm a curious guy. And that's what it seems like to me, that everybody has to tweak something to make their beautiful idea work.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, we may get onto this, but with theories of determinism, right? The idea that these lower levels are causally comprehensive, which that can allow some, well, the idea that that's true, Even actually the idea that classical physics is completely deterministic involves a lot of these fudges and tweaks and little things that aren't advertised in the propaganda that everything is completely determined, right? So as it happens, you know, when you dig into this, and this actually bears on the question of whether any of these claims are empirically distinguishable from each other. It turns out that within physics, there's all kinds of assumptions that have to be made and idealizations that have to be made in order to make classical physics deterministic, right? It's not a result of classical physics, that the universe is deterministic. It's an assumption that's baked into it, and that has to be defended by a lot of arcane knob twisting and little assumptions and even very, very broad mathematical idealizations that couldn't possibly hold in the real universe, or that just simply don't apply to things in the physical world. They're just mathematical abstractions. So yeah, it's interesting when you scratch a little below the sort of the way many of these claims are presented, then you get to exactly the type of thing that you're talking about, not just in the experiments, but in the theory itself, that the theory has to be supplemented with all kinds of other things to keep everything nice and orderly, and to dispel the threat of anarchy that comes with any sort of indeterminism.
Well, and I think that's a good segue into actually talking about the book, because I think the way you try to get away from even having to make an initial assumption is, and I was surprised, is at the beginning of your book, you start with single cell organisms. And then I think to myself, is he saying they have free will? Is he not saying they have free will? Is he saying because something decides I need to move, I need to flagellate, I need to crawl, I need to spin? And I'm thinking, okay, is that free will? And that's the second part of your subtitle, Evolution Giving Us This Gift. Yes. Those first guys, they gave it, you know, you have a tail. Before you had a tail, you couldn't do anything.
Right, exactly, yeah. So first of all, what I would say is, just for conventional reasons, I reserve the term free will for humans, just because there's no point getting people's backs up by applying it to non-human organisms, right?
So your title does that.
Well, the title is How Evolution Gave Us Free Will, right? So humans. And free will is just what I call the version of agency that we have as humans. So the agency is the more general thing. But also the other important thing is that I'm not interested in making sharp lines and saying this kind of a thing is an agent, and before that there was no agency. I think you can go from a kind of proto basal agency of the kind that we see in single-celled organisms up to very, very complicated versions of agency that warrant being called free will in humans. That's the idea. So yeah, I think the reason I start with very simple organisms, and indeed with the origin of life itself, is that that agency is the distinguishing feature of living from non-living things, I think. And so it's really important to understand, well, what does it mean? What is it to be a living thing? What is it to be a self that has some continuity through time? And so you can think of living things as, interlocking patterns of dynamic processes that are all reinforcing each other in a big kind of regime of constraints that keeps itself going through time. But to do that, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, if that's true, then, and you bring it up, I won't bring up anything that you didn't bring up in the book. You know, you say Dostoevsky. And so I'm looking at Raskolnikov. How is he any different than the guy with the tail? Because the whole idea of the book is his killing the landlady and the daughter, is this, and he says it's not free will. But you say, I assume, that it is free will.
Yeah. Well, I would say that in general, human beings have the capacity for free will.
Oh.
That doesn't mean that in every instance, every action is an expression of free will, because that freedom can be more or less constrained by circumstances in different situations. So again, I don't want to make absolutist claims. I want to come to an understanding of the kind of control that we have over our behavior as an evolved biological capacity, and an understanding of how that capacity can vary between people, between, under different circumstances, and so on. And the difference between what the version that we have, the strong version that we have in human beings, and that has gotten more sophisticated through time, from the very basic kind of version that you see like in a bacterium, well, there's a lot of differences, One is that, you know, in a bacterium, it's trying to survive in a changeable world. And a good thing to do, or to be able to do in that situation, is to be able to get some information about what's out in the world and to be able to react to it appropriately. So, for example, being able to move, rotating its little outboard motor flagellum towards, but to move towards a food source, right? That's a good thing to do. So that's what we can call a control policy that is kind of wired into the biochemistry of the bacterium by the action of natural selection. So it's got, it's effectively acting for a reason, but it's not a reason that it figured out by itself. It's a reason that evolution figured out in a sense. Now, when once you get nervous systems, you get individual organisms that, first of all, can deal with a lot more different kinds of stimuli at once. So they're not reacting to individual things. They're assessing a whole scenario, and they're coming to a centralized kind of decision about what to do. But secondly, they learn, right? They learn from experience. That's the great thing about nervous systems. And so what that means is that individual organisms, through their lifetime, now they acquire knowledge that gives them better models of the world. It gives them better causal power to control themselves and the world. But it also means they're acting for their own reasons, right? Not just natural selection's reasons. And then things get more complicated. Sorry, go ahead.
What I was going to say was, like, I don't know, it sounded like you're giving Raskolnikov a free pass to a certain extent. And that goes directly to your research, because you say, you know, variations in human faculties with regard to psychiatric and neurological disease. Raskolnikov obviously had some type of irregularity, if you want to call it a disease. So when that happens, does your free will disintegrate, or are you operating on somebody else's free will because you're not a complete human being?
Well, so yes, in a sense, I would say that your free will, that the capacity for deliberative, rational control can absolutely be infringed or impinged upon by different kinds of circumstances. You absolutely see that with mental illness, with things like schizophrenia, for example, dementia, you know, very obviously with drug addiction. You can see it with head injuries, which particularly, you know, ones that damage the prefrontal cortex, which are you know, areas of the brain that support the capacities that psychologists call executive function, which is, you know, planning, decision making, maintaining actions over time, understanding things have changed in the world, shifting goals appropriately, keeping things in working memory, all of the cognitive capacities we need to adaptively control our behavior over, not just in an instant, right? Because that's not how we live our lives. We're not just reacting to isolated stimuli moment by moment. We're guiding our own behavior through time and managing agendas and plans and so on to achieve both short-term goals and long-term goals. And of course, we're juggling, right? We're trying to optimize over many, many variables all at once. Hugely complex task. So if we don't have some kind of a science that allows us to understand how we do those things, where the self is still part of that science, right? It's not just, we're not just reducing it to the machinery. It's still a holistic enterprise that a living self is engaged in. If we don't understand that, then what are we even noticing? Like, if we're saying there's no free will ever, no one's ever in control of their actions, what are we noticing when we distinguish the behavior of someone who's a drug addict from someone who isn't, or someone who's in the midst of a psychotic episode from someone who isn't? You know, or a child from an adult. Well, you know, what are we noticing? So all I'm saying there is that I would like to see free will as a naturalized concept that represents these evolved biological capacities, a suite of capacities, not just one thing, that because their biological capacities depend on some physical instantiation in our bodies and some systems, but they can't be reduced to it, right? We still need to think holistically.
Well, if you go back to what I consider, it's not simple, but the simplest thing to understand in your research, synesthesia, the red I see is the red you smell. the sound I hear is the sound you see. What does that do to this whole theory? Because that means all of us are separate. We don't know what the other guy is thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so first of all, yeah, synesthesia is a wonderful example that our perceptual experiences differ in ways that are in many more ways than people think of. So in synesthesia, there's a sort of called a mixing of the senses where, for example, when you hear something, you might see a particular color out in the world or smell something or taste something and so on. So it's a very clear example, philosophically really, really interesting because of it, that people's individual perceptual experience is not the same. And of course, our individual cognitive experiences are not the same. And our, you know, the tuning of our behavioral parameters are not the same. So, you know, you could say, well, because of that, because we all have these different, slightly different tunings that we call personality traits, which affect our decision-making. I mean, that's basically what a personality trait is. It's a description of patterns of behavior across many sort of contexts, that therefore we're not in charge because we didn't choose any of that. So I would say, again, it's absolutely true that there are loads of past influences on our behavior. That includes the way that we ourselves are configured by evolution, by our own genetics, by the way our brain happened to develop, and by past experiences. But two important things. First of all those factors don't preclude that, you know, they can inform and influence decisions. They can shape the possibility space. They don't say that there's only one option ever in every circumstance, right? Which is what Robert Sapolsky claims, for example. Again, without evidence, right? He gives evidence of the effects, the influence of all these things separately, but then he just makes a leap to say that leaves no room for you to be doing anything. And that's not supported by any empirical evidence at all. And then the second question is this idea that all of those experiences have just happened to us, right? It's a very passive view. It's like either it's nature or nurture. And either one, it's either your genes or the way you were brought up, either one was passive things that shaped you, that molded you, and now there's nothing you can do about it. And there never was. And that just doesn't seem to be an accurate description of how our character develops, actually, because a lot of our character and habits and plans and projects and attitudes and dispositions emerge through the accumulation of our own choices as we go through life, right? Our experiences are not just things that happen to us. We choose them, we craft them, we create them, we select our environments as we go along as an exercise of our own agency that in turn feeds back onto the kinds of, like I said, habits and adaptations that we individually develop that come to be what we call our character, which is, you know, a much more sophisticated suite of characteristics than these very simple, abstracted personality traits like, you know, conscientiousness or neuroticism or whatever.
You know, one of the things you say that you say things don't just happen to themselves, or no, things happen to them, not in the way that we do things, like you were talking about creating our environment, this. Yeah. But, you know, if you're talking about rocks or spoons or electrons, I mean, rocks do fall and spoons do stir and electrons do jump. And, you know, it's a really, I'm sorry, it's a really close call for me. If an electron jumps, is it thinking of doing, you know, it's time for me to go.
The question is that a doing or a happening, right? And yeah. So I'm perfectly happy with the idea that describing it as a happening doesn't leave anything out. Whereas describing what we're doing right now as just stuff happening is leaving things out, right? It's leaving out our reasons. It's leaving out our goals. It's leaving out the choices that we have. It's leaving out the exercise of decision-making in settling those choices and so on. None of that is happening when an electron jumps from one orbital to another or when a rock falls down a hill, right? There's just, for me, there's a completely different kind of causation at play that simply doesn't exist in the non-living world, right? So it's not just Everything is decided by the playing out of these physical forces. And this starts again with the simplest organism, which is why I wanted to start there, because it can ground that distinction of different types of causation. For example, so we've got a living organism. One of the things that defines an organism is it has a boundary, right? There's an edge to it, and there's an inside, and there's everything else, right? So this boundary defines the entity and the rest of the universe, the rest of the world. And so that's a causally insulating boundary. There's lots of physical causes happening outside that don't make it through, right? So it's not in equilibrium causally with the environment, and it's trying to stay that way. And one of the ways it can stay that way is by getting information about things out in the world where, you know, it's got little antennae that can bind, say, a chemical. And when that happens, it affects the behavior of the organism, but not through physical causation. It's not an exchange of energy or matter that's pushing anything around. It's an exchange of information, right? There's a little conformational change inside the bacterium, which just acts as a signal. And so being sensitive to information is one of the clear sort of differences between living and non-living things. And to me, that's a very different kind of causation.
Well, you're talking about outsides and insides, and you're talking about nature and nurture. Suppose the moment a child is born, when a child is born, there is no inside or outside. It is the universe. It is the one. It's not till it seeks its mother's breast that there's something else. So the moment the baby is born, this Buddha baby, it is the universe, going back to my solipsistic tendencies.
Yeah, well, so there's two ways to think about that. One is it may think it's the universe and be wrong, right? I mean, that's the way I would think about it. Well, I don't know what a baby is thinking. But yeah, the solipsistic view is one of those ones which, again, like some of the other ones you referred to, is kind of unfalsifiable. But to me, it's a bit like panpsychism. It just doesn't do any useful work for me. You know, it's not helping me understand anything better. It's not leading to any kind of, empirical avenue of research that I think could help me understand the phenomena that I'm after.
Well, then why is yours non-falsifiable? Is it simply because you're using science to explain why this is the way it is? Essentially, starting with single-celled organisms at the beginning of the book.
I mean, I've wondered about this, whether the whole sort of framework that I offer is amounts to a scientific hypothesis that's falsifiable. And I don't really think it does necessarily, because it's not one very specific kind of thing that you could do an experiment to test and it would prove one way or another. It's a perspective and a collective framework that I think is a useful way of looking at the phenomena that we're interested in, which I think splits the difference between the completely reductive view that says all the causation is happening down at the low levels, and the agent disappears from that view. Cognition, mentality evaporates from that. There's nothing for it to do anymore because the brain is doing everything, or physics is doing everything. You know, that's one extreme. And then the other extreme is a sort of a spiritual, immaterial dualism, invoking some kind of a soul or a spirit, basically magic, right? So I don't like either of those views. I'd rather have a naturalistic way of thinking about macroscopic level causation and causation by entities, by selves and complex systems that can't be reduced to the lowest levels, but that also isn't magic.
Well, like I said, I'm not going to refer to anything that wasn't in the book. And you quote these guys that disagree with you, who are smarter than both of us, Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene, and they totally disagree with you. And so for me, so what am I supposed to do?
So this is where these claims that physics is completely deterministic come into play. And it turns out that they're just, like I said, based on a load of assumptions. And that's not me saying that. That's loads and loads of other physicists saying that.
There's a whole Stephen other... Hawking. You're saying Stephen Hawking is just wrong, and I'm,
I am. Yes, he was wrong on that particular one. Yeah, he's not the Pope, I mean, he's not, you know, he's fallible like everybody else. And it turns out, you know, all scientists tend to focus on very particular things. And he was an expert on particular things, and he wasn't an expert on free will, and maybe not even on the question of determinism as a physical claim or a metaphysical claim. So there's a whole literature out there of physics literature showing why determinism is not the case, why it couldn't be the case, why it never was the case, why it's always been based on a bunch of assumptions, why even at classical levels, it couldn't be that the current state of the universe, exhaustively defined, plus the laws of physics determine every possible future state. And I'll tell you, I mean, the basic reason is that if that were for that to be true, the current physical configuration of the universe would have to contain infinite amount of information. And information has to have a physical instantiation, and the amount of information you can put into a finite amount of space is itself finite. So
we go back to Democritus and Epicurus.
Yes.
So if you guys were all at a dinner party, so would you end up like boxing, or would be like Wittgenstein's poker? I mean,
poker. Yeah. Well, I'd be on Epicurus's side. So Epicurus, this is a fascinating part of this, right? Is that it goes back to the ancient Greek atomists. So Democritus and Leucippus proposed amazingly, presciently, the idea that the physical matter is composed of atoms, which means things that are indivisible, right? So small, very small, tiny units, right? And Democritus proposed that those atoms move in predetermined ways. So in you know, their terminology, they fall in straight lines and they never diverge from them. And Epicurus looked at that claim and thought that it was as absurd as the claim that we discussed earlier, that everything that we're saying right now was determined from the point of the Big Bang, right? So he said, first of all, if that were true, there could be no free will. And it seems like there is. Therefore, I think your claim is bogus. That's the ancient Greek word, bogus. And then secondly, he also thought, if that were true, again, if there was everything was predetermined at the lowest level, you wouldn't even get any kind of macroscopic complexity. You wouldn't get complex functional structures emerging. Because why would you? Atoms are just going to do what they're going to do. What does it? How does any functionality emerge? And I think that's a really interesting insight. There's nothing new under the sun. We're still having the same sort of discussion that Democritus and Epicurus were having. Actually, I'm not sure they were contemporary. So I don't think they were ever at dinner together.
Well, this is the law of large numbers too. And then you're going back to Sabine a little bit. But, you know, but like I said, okay, I think you say things fall apart, the center cannot hold. And you're quoting Yeats, and you're talking about entropy, and then you say flames quickly blow out, life goes on. Well, yeah, life goes on, but lives don't. And so is death an exercise of free will?
No, I think death is the just the ultimate failure of living systems to keep going, although you could phrase it a different way. So one way to look at complex dynamical systems like that, and this includes things like a tornado or a whirlpool, is that they're dissipative systems. So they're dissipating energy as quickly as they can. They're actually, even though they look ordered, they're actually making the universe increase its overall entropy as quickly as possible. Sure. And one way to think about living things is that they're also organized as dissipative systems that should, in theory, blow themselves out. It's just that there's another sort of principle at play, which is that ones that are good at persisting keep persisting, right? So you get this selection for organization. So in a sense, they're frustrated, dissipative systems. They're trying to blow themselves out, and they're continually failing until they finally expire. Yeah.
Well, yeah, in 20 years, I couldn't have this conversation with you because I'll be back to what I was, ashes to ash, and going back to the Greeks. So if that's the case, what you're kind of saying, it sounds like this hive mind, like, okay, I die, you die, but as you say, life goes on. Yeah. So there's some kind of universe. That would be an assumption, big assumption for you. It's like, is there a universal free will? In which case, you know?
Yeah. So what I mean by that, life goes on, is first of all, that individual lives go on for some time, right? They do, they try to go on in just in thermodynamic terms, right? They're doing work to stay alive, but inevitably they fail, right? So at some point. However, of course, because we have evolution and because we have genetic material and reproduction and so on, the lineages can go on for, you know, an indefinite amount of time, unless we really, you know, destroy the planet. So life writ large, right, not individual lives or individual selves, but there's a continuity through time of life from these, the, you know, from the earliest point to everything that we see now. And so, you know, I don't think that requires any kind of cosmic teleology or the universe wanting there to be life or anything like that. It's just that it's allowed, right? The thermodynamics says you can do that for a while, right? Locally, you can increase the order, especially if it's at the cost of taking in free energy and making the whole rest of the universe more higher entropy while you're doing it. So, yeah, I don't think the universe isn't trying to do it, or at least, again, that invoking that doesn't do any work for me. It's not necessary to think that. It just allows it to happen, and it will allow it to happen for as long as these things are successful at persisting.
Well, you can't argue with the fact that this makes my brain hurt. Yeah. I mean, it does. I mean, if you look back at the Godhead, David Chalmers, and you go, okay, to me, the easy problem and the hard problem is pretty damn obvious. I mean, you can look at a clock and you can take it apart and, you know, the dials, the hands, the movement, the escapement, the pendulum. But okay, you take it apart, but okay, what is time? You took the clock apart, you figured it out, right, but you still haven't gotten to the point of what is time. And that goes to me, that goes to your argument. So what exactly is free will? I tell you to move your hand, you do, that's an exercise of free will. You don't, that's an exercise of free will. And there's all the experiments that say you move your hand before the thought of moving your hand occurs.
Yeah. So well, there's a lot on that. Let me pick up on two things. First of all,
all right.
First of all, the concept of time, which I think is really crucial. And in fact, yeah, I never thought I would get into the physics of time, which I do in the book, but more generally, I think the idea that we can understand living things instantaneously, we can look at them as a system, a physical system that's configured a certain way right now and understand what it's doing, is just missing the point. The whole thing, the whole shtick of life is persisting through time, right? Continuity through time is the only thing that makes something a self. It just doesn't apply. The concept doesn't apply in an instant. And so, you know, of course, that means that selves draw on their past history to come up with reasons of what's adaptive to do in the service of their future selves. So all of that is just a normal aspect of, not normal, it's the essential aspect of living things, of biology. Biology has to be a historical science that looks at processes extended through time. And then the other thing is these questions of when you're making a decision, you know, whether your brain is doing it or whether you're doing it. And a lot of neuroscientists might say, or some at least would say, you know, every time we find some bit of the brain that's involved in processes of decision making, that just shows it's your brain doing it. It's not you, right? And so a large part of the argument in the book is to try to rebut that view, to say, no, it's you. You're using your brain to make the decisions. However, it's also true that there are some instances in which we don't really care, right? So there are some sort of decisions that we make that have no material consequence, like those famous experiments of lifting your hand every once in a while. And it may absolutely be that under circumstances like that, we decide to let some of the noisiness and randomness of our neurons be the thing that decides when on a whim we lift our finger or not. But that doesn't mean every decision is like that, right? That's an inconsequential decision, a little act, right, that nobody cares about. But there are loads of deliberative decisions that we do take our time thinking about, that we do for reasons that we can articulate, that we can inspect, that we can judge to see whether, for example, our various beliefs are consistent with each other, to judge how certain we are, how confident we are in our various beliefs. So all of those metacognitive capacities that humans have, the really things that really, really distinguish us from other animals, I think, are the things that for me really justify using the term free will when it comes to humans, because we demonstrably can think about our own thoughts and reason about our reasons, and we do, and we can tell each other about them and so on. And for me, that just is the phenomenon of rational control made evident to ourselves and to each other.
Well, those things that you say we don't care about, so they just happen, and they, you know, it's not something we actually have to exercise free will for. And again, your book, you know, you talk about, are we player one or are we NPCs? So you're saying that we are an amalgam of both, and there's part of us that is an NPC, but the player one is what you and I are doing right now?
Yeah, well, in a sense, yeah. And so, you know, this is very similar to what Danny Kahneman calls system one and system two, and which, you know, goes back to Freud and others about, you know, subconscious mind and so on. So when we are figuring out what to do, again, this is why thinking of it as a process through time is important. Right, we encounter some scenario, we think, well, here's a few options I could do. Let me think in my mind what might be a good one. What are the likely outcomes of these scenarios? And then pick the one that I think is going to have the highest utility for me across the whole range of goals that I'm entertaining at the moment. Right? But we learn from that. So the next time we encounter a scenario, we may be more likely to do action A versus action B if it had turned out well the last time. And so as time goes on, we develop these habits where the next, you know, many, many times after having done it many times, we may not have to think about it at all. It may become habitual. And that's good, right? That's part of us deciding what to do, because we've been involved in that process by which our habits emerge. It's not, you know, some people would point to something being habitual or automatic and say, look, you didn't choose to do that. I did choose to do that. Who do you think made that habit? It was me. I made that habit through time, right? And so that's a super, super efficient way to get around. So what I'm suggesting is that we have a range of levels of behavioral control, many of which are habitual and automatic because we've done the hard work already of thinking about what to do and we paid attention to the outcomes. And then there may be scenarios where, you know, we don't really know what to do, we don't really care, and it's important to do something, maybe not important which it is, but we just go, I don't care, right? And then there's other ones that are really, really deliberative, you know, whether to take a job, whether to accept a marriage proposal, or even just like, you know, the next words to say in a conversation like we're having. I'm thinking about them as we're going along.
Well, look, okay, so let's conclude this way. We've talked about a lot of people, and you're not a narcissist. So you wrote this for readers like me. And so what would you say? You're not telling me what to believe, but what would you say you want the reader to take away from this, to continue? I mean, you know, you've said that Stephen Hawking is wrong, Brian Greene is wrong. Is Sapolsky like, you guys get along when you talk?
Oh yeah, he's super congenial, affable guy. Yeah, he's very, very likable guy to chat with, but we completely disagree.
Yeah. Where does that leave me?
Well, I guess you have a choice of what to believe.
That's good. That's the best thing. That's the best thing you can take away from this. I have a choice.
Yeah. I mean, really what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the view that I put forward in the book is that there is a naturalistic way to think about how entities, organisms, can act as causal agents in the world. And that includes human beings. And it's not an absolutist statement. It's not the far end of a spectrum. It's, I hope, a kind of a nuanced view that's like I said, sort of multi-layer, right? There's not just one type of decision-making. There's not just one capacity or causal power involved. There's all these different kinds of things woven in with each other that manifest differently depending on the scenario, that allow us to manage our behavior through time, not just reacting not just reacting to individual isolated stimuli. We're proactive. We guide our behavior through time. And to me, that's a richer view of behavior. And it's also just, again, you know, I come back to where we started. It matches the phenomenology of our existence much better than these really strong claims that everything that you do and say and think was predetermined eons ago.
Well, enriching or... Yeah, so because of determinism and the manner in which it works, should we be happier because we read your book and believe in it? Because then we actually have control over our lives. So we can make moral and familial decisions that we might have thought otherwise weren't really within our own power.
I don't think even the most avowed free will skeptics actually live their lives as if they have no free will. I think everybody goes around making these moral judgments, making decisions, deciding what to do, even if they think that they're not. So my book is the least sensational sort of conclusion, which is everything you thought about how we live our lives is fine. It's pretty good. And here's why scientifically it can be fine, right? I mean, that's I'm defending common sense views of our behavior and our choices and our responsibility and so on, I think, and saying none of that violates science or is anti-physicalist or requires any sort of magical, supernatural intervention by immaterial souls or spirits. It can be a perfectly scientific, but I hope still humanistic view of what it means to be a human being, or even more fundamentally, what it means to be a living organism.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, I just thought of something. You know, this concept of enjoy every moment, like I can look out the window, see it's a beautiful day here, the trees are there, and just that moment, like Warren Zevon said before he died, just enjoy every sandwich. And Kurt Vonnegut tells a story about this very question. He said he had this uncle who wasn't, you know, the smartest guy. He was like a machinist, but he would take Vonnegut fishing, and they wouldn't be catching any fish. They'd just be sitting there on the bank. The sun would be shining, and his uncle would turn to him and he goes, "This is just fine." And it is. And I think a lot of all this talk from all of you guys is, if you live in the moment, then everything is kind of just fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think certainly that, I guess I would say you don't have to be having existential crises prompted by you know, neuroscience or physics, because they're not warranted. As for living in the moment, why, I think what's really interesting about that is that it gets to this idea of the continuity of the self through time, and that in any moment, you're just a kind of a momentary avatar of this self that extends along this timeline. And you know, so yeah, you can choose. Of course, we should, you know, enjoy the present, but I don't think we can get away from our past history or away from the fact that our actions are inevitably directed towards the future. So that's a slightly different perspective.
If you say a momentary avatar, it's kind of a much more holistic approach to your book. Yeah. Because then you do, I don't, yeah, because it's much more encompassing if you can say, notwithstanding the fact that we might be momentarily an avatar, overarching is the fact that we're constantly choosing. And we make this based on free will.
Yeah, and I think that's the, you know, the, in a sense, that's a beautiful picture that both those things are true, right? They're not necessarily in any conflict with each other. There may be a sort of a complementarity to them.
Well, okay. That was great. Thank you so much. When I interview Sabine, I'm going to say, this is what Kevin said.
Great, okay.
And then I'll get back to her response.
Great.
But thank you so much. This was so stimulating. I really enjoy talking to you about all this. And the book is great. And as I say sometimes, but not always, it'll be on the front table in our bookstore. Cover's great, title's great, and I think it's going to interest a lot of people. And it already has, because it was, you know, last year.
Yeah, that's great. Sam, thanks so much for the conversation. There were some really, really great questions in there. So very, very fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Okay. Bye-bye.